Good afternoon. This is the LaRue Show for July 11th, 2009. This is Paul Gallagher. I'm your host today with Tony Papert, who for many years has been a director of intelligence for the LaRouche movement, and Mike Billington, who's on with us from outside the studio from Ohio, who is head of the Asia desk of EIR, and also does a great deal of the LaRouche movement's diplomatic and contact work with people all over Asia, people in leading positions, scholarly and diplomatic, all over Asia. And here's what we'll be discussing today. The LaRouche Political Action Committee is about to release the a pamphlet form transcript of the extremely important June 27th webcast that Lyndon LaRouche held on that date. Crucial part of the title of that pamphlet is Britain Delenda Est. Britain must be destroyed. The British Empire must be destroyed. In that webcast, which is about to be published for very wide circulation and study, there was a truly extraordinary dialogue, question and answer dialogue for several hours, involving many people in the United States who've been advisors in the recent period, either to the Obama White House or to individuals in the Senate and the House or to both, who clearly from their questions are now seeing that the Obama presidency is turning quickly into a failure, and in fact a British-directed failure, and were with great breadth and a lot of urgency trying to come to grips with what Lyndon LaRouche has said about the Obama administration since early April, and the way in which he has forecast that British-directed failure and the disaster of the policies coming out of Washington. And we're trying to come to grips with a new policy, a way of bringing that administration under control, dramatically changing policy, getting a recovery going. Who can do it? What countries have to be taking the lead in doing it, and how that is to be done? And it's in that connection that LaRouche discussed in great depth in that webcast about to be published the threat to humanity of the British Empire in a period of economic collapse, in an economy which is worldwide collapsing to the depths, of the British Empire going for their end game, and their end game to destroy nation states and to destroy and drive back economies worldwide to a period hundreds of years ago, a kind of a world of green fascism in which the technological progress and industrial progress of the last hundreds of years is rolled back, and the population of the world is rolled back by billions in such an endgame. So today we're discussing that endgame that the British imperial circles have gone to in this global financial disintegration, and specifically the way in which that British imperial endgame policy is working itself out and being played out in the so-called arc of crisis, that large area of the world which LaRouche identified as the most dangerous area of British imperial operations in a fundamental 1999 TV broadcast that he made as a candidate for president. He called that broadcast Storm Over Asia, and it is properly where we start today. So let me start with Tony Papert, one of Lyndon LaRouche's intelligence directors and organizing directors for many years, and ask Tony to take it from that standpoint of the arc of crisis that LaRouche identified and the storm over Asia in that video in 99. What is meant by this, and what's the danger of the developments there now?
It's as Franklin Roosevelt said in a fireside chat, you should take out your map. It's unfortunate we're on radio, and not television. But
people can take their maps out nonetheless.
Yes, correct. If you take out a map, you see an enormous belt crossing nations and continents, which begins in Western China, which is in the news now every day with riots, moves west over India or through a part of India to Pakistan, and then further west to Afghanistan, further west to Iran. So we're this way crossing the entire Eurasian continent, or almost all of it. And then from Iran, you look down to down and west to Syria. You look down to Iraq, Jordan, Israel, and then continuing west from Iran, you get to the Caucasus, including Georgia and the Caucasus areas of Russia. Now, I mean, what Lyndon LaRouche pointed to in that 1999 film is that the British were even back then already conducting destabilization throughout this entire area, with the immediate targets today of Iran and India, and the further targets of China and Russia, both of which are within this area in part, significant part. Now he pointed to this development in 99, but it's in much more vigorous destabilization, potential collapse of governments now, aided by the fact that we have now a British puppet in the White House, Barack Obama. So the British Empire is using historical assets. The British Empire, which is also the empire of the world monetary system, is using historical assets throughout this area to bring down the nation states, especially the largest and most important, China, India, Russia, to bring down nation states in behalf of what they imagine will be the final triumph of the British Empire in a world which is, as Paul indicated, in a world which will be rapidly, within perhaps two generations or less, depopulated from a present 6.7 billion people down to the level of 2 billion, which Britain's Prince Philip, whom Obama met there recently in Britain, to the 2 billion which Prince Philip considers the appropriate population. And as LaRouche pointed out, it probably continue down, not even stop it. If these plans were realized, it would continue down, not even stop at 2 billion, but continue down perhaps to 500 million or something of that sort. So the British Empire in this way imagines that it's making the last stand against the nation state, especially its historic enemy, since really before our foundation as a nation, the United States. But in reality, the only thing will happen is that humanity as biological existence of all people, probably, but human civilization and the kind of human life which people term civilized, which they would find acceptable, that a human civilization will go down with the British Empire, which can never save itself under any circumstances. So this is the end game of what LaRouche pointed to in that 1999 Storm Over Asia video. And I think Mike will have more to say about many aspects of this, but many of you realize, I think, that that Iran, for instance, is going through a crisis. It's going through a crisis which is like which resembles in some respect the other previous crises of 20th century Iran, the 1910 crisis, the crisis with Mossadegh in the 1950s, the Islamic Revolution with Khomeini in 1979 and so forth. But as the Iranians themselves have said, deeply involved with all four feet in this crisis is Britain. I mean, the Iranians have actually said this and documented this, despite their differences with each other on many other issues. So in the midst of the Iran crisis is Britain. Britain is in there in four feet destabilizing Iran. At the same time, it has been released by the British press that Saudi Arabia is in negotiations with Israel for Israeli overflights over Saudi Arabia to attack presumed nuclear sites in Iran, which would plunge the entire greater Middle East area into a much higher... I mean, in a sense, the area is in a slow form of warfare now, but that would plunge that entire area into warfare. So that's then Western China, as Mike will explain. I mean, as the outcome really very visible of historic efforts to destabilize and break up China, the British have engaged in since the 18th century. Now you have massive riots in Western China. The president of China, Hu Jintao, had to fly home and miss the Group of Eight summit in Italy because of that situation. Pakistan is in the midst of a war against militants in Pakistan. Afghanistan, of course, the United States has committed more troops. There's 20,000 Marines just sent to southern Afghanistan who were supposed to so-called clear and hold areas there. Actually, the Taliban, who were they were sent to fight, have left the area. The opium which they were sent to seize has been withdrawn from the area. The fighting in Pakistan is sending various sorts of Islamic militants, including the Uyghurs, who also dwell in China, over Pakistan borders, among other things, into China, feeding into the riots in Western China, in Xinjiang province, which the British are directly involved in through exile organizations. At the same time all this has been happening, there has been upsurges of assassinations and bombings in the Caucasus area, again continuing west across Eurasia, in the Caucasus areas of Russia. So we're in the midst of a massive British destabilization across this entire arc of crisis. And at the same time, which is prejudges everything, or sets the framework for everything we're discussing, the whole world economic system has crashed. We may be weeks or days, we may be longer, but we may be weeks or days from a total systemic failure in which governments like, for instance, the state government of California now become meaningless. Governments become unable to operate. So that's the situation in which this British action is taking place. The ultimate outcome of this crisis must be either a collapse of civilization on the one hand, or the triumph of the nation state, of which the United States is the primary example, a nation state set up in the beginning in opposition to that world British Empire. The only outcome of this crisis is the triumph either of the nation state led by the United States or the collapse of civilization at large. And these British destabilizations are attempting to prejudge that outcome because they want, as they have for centuries, they want to destroy China. They want to destroy Russia. They want to destroy India, as they, you know, tried to do when they left there as colonial masters, supposedly, in the late 1940s. On the other hand, functioning national governments in Russia, in China, and India, cooperating with the United States, replacing this British international monetary system with a new credit system, is the only exit from the crisis. So this is what's being... foreshadowed in this crisis, this storm over Asia, which LaRouche forecast in 1999.
But if I could bring this to the Obama administration, there's very significant changes going on, it seems to me, in the depth, in the quicksand in this area of American military forces. The Obama White House came in with a very aggressive policy for Pakistan, both for pushing the Pakistani army into action and for increasing the bombings in Pakistan by our drones, and now has started a much bigger commitment war in Afghanistan. And apparently the news today or yesterday was that the new U.S. commander there, for the White House having just fired the previous guy, McChrystal, the new commander, has said it's got to be considerably bigger war than has been talked about up to now. A good deal more than 17,000 more troops, a lot more than $7 or $8 billion more dollars this year. It's got to grow very rapidly. What's the role of this? I mean, this brings the United States in directly as a militarily land war in Asia, several land wars in Asia.
It's completely insane. I mean, there's no realistic objective for the United States in there. We're just sending in troops to get shot for no reason. There is really no possible objective. Because 20,000 Marines can clear and hold at most a tiny area of Helmand Province, which in fact the Taliban have abandoned. That is, they've abandoned the areas where the Marines are, taking their opium with them. So they're only going there as targets to be shot at. I mean, this is a fool's errand. This is a quicksand mission in Asia, which is set out for the United States by Britain from the beginning. That war in Afghanistan, as also the war in Iraq, which we were dragged into by Tony Blair, the previous Prime Minister of Britain, who is now Obama's great confidant, as he was a confidant of George W. Bush. Mm-hmm. In fact, we were discussing before the show, there's going to be a new feature going up on LaRouche Pack and EIR probably within some hours, which is an exclusive by Jeff Steinberg called 9/11 Cover Blown. And what he does is take recent releases, documents released very late in the game, by the 9/11 Commission and by the House Senate Investigating Committee into 9/11, and documents which were obtained by families attempting to sue Saudi Arabia, that is, families of 9/11 victims, attempting to sue Saudi Arabia for their involvement in 9/11. And he puts these things together to show that 9/11 was a British-Saudi intelligence operation. This stuff has been, I mean, some of the elements of this were known before, but the largest parts of the picture have been hidden until this stuff just came out. And it shows that 9/11, with the attempt to establish here a George W. Bush dictatorship and involve the U.S. in the war in Iraq and the war in Afghanistan, or in the other order, was all a knowing joint British-Saudi project dating back to the huge British-Saudi weapons deal on the Yamama beginning in 1985, which established a British-Saudi secret slush fund of several hundred billion dollars, from which came, as Jeff's article shows, the subsidies, the upkeep, the flight training of the 9/11 hijackers.
Mike, let me bring you in on a question again of China. LaRouche has been saying for several years, and of course now more recently it's becoming obvious to anyone who looks, that the financial collapse either gets turned around by some sort of extremely creative and productive cooperation involving the United States and China, and of course Russia also, or there could be a real acceleration of the destruction of the financial system, and particularly a collapse of the dollar, if relations between the United States and China get blown up. So could you address in that context what's actually going on now? This is the second area of China within, if I remember rightly, 9 months, to be very severely hit with rioting, where a very strong government response has been required. Is there a danger of these parts of China being split off, and what impact is this having on the country?
Well, I think this is precisely what the British are targeting. The Tibet destabilization last year, around the Olympic period, and now the Uyghur, which are very, very much connected, in the sense that, in fact, the overseas centers for both the Uyghur and the Tibetan movements around the Dalai Lama tend to be in the same offices run by precisely the same British and the British allied American interests. In order to achieve exactly what you said, the attempt to disrupt and destroy the sovereignty of China. And as you indicated, the global financial crisis, and as LaRouche has emphasized over and over, the nation which can be expected to be most severely and drastically affected by this is China, that it has been set up by the globalization process. Run by the British Empire, with globalization just being another word, really, for imperialism or colonialization, that they became increasingly dependent on their export economy, utilizing their cheap labor to produce goods to be sold overseas to the U.S. and to Europe and elsewhere, but without really being paid what it costs to produce the goods of a modern economy, not being paid enough to not only get a little cash in the bank, but to be able to invest in the kind of vast infrastructure that China needs for its huge population and its huge territory. The result is now that this importer of last resort, as it used to be called, the U.S. and Europe and the entire world economy, is in a state of absolute collapse. The Chinese exports have disappeared, been cut drastically, nearly in half in many cases, leaving millions of Chinese peasants who had left the land and come into the export zones along the coast to produce in these export factories are now being driven back into the countryside, more and more desperate. The Chinese are doing a number of things to try to reverse this, but this is a problem beyond the ability of them to solve this internally. And if you add then to that, one aspect that we haven't mentioned about this whole arc of crisis is the central role of the drug trafficking.
Right.
That, as everybody knows, since the time NATO took over Afghanistan under U.S. and British direction, that nation was turned into the producer of the many multiples of the quantities of opium that had been produced in previous eras in the entire world. And it's extremely important to see that what's taking place right now with the destabilization and potential collapse in Pakistan is not only are many of the insurgents who have been trained over the last several decades by British and Saudi Wahhabi networks being pushed out of Pakistan into Central Asia and into Western China, Uyghurs and so forth. But this is being accompanied by a massive increase of drug exports from these regions, increasingly over these last 9 years, 8 years since the invasion of Afghanistan, which Viktor Ivanov, the head of the Russian Russian drug czar, has identified in public conferences as the new opium war, that this is like the 19th century British opium wars against China, in which they produced massive amounts of opium in the Raj in India and Burma and used that to force it upon the Chinese and waged war against them when they put up resistance to the importation of these huge quantities of opium. And having won these two opium wars in the 1840s and 50s basically succeeded in forcing massive drugs down the throats of the Chinese population, destroying them culturally and physically, as well as controlling their economy. And this is what the Russians see happening to them today, with much of the drugs being produced out of Afghanistan pouring across the borders into Central Asia and into Russia. So with this kind of drugs and the related organized crime apparatuses and the terrorist networks trained and set in motion by this Anglo-Saudi alliance empire, coming into Western China at the same time that many of the people from the Xinjiang area, the Uyghurs and others, had been gone off to the coast of China to be part of this export industry, who are now being forced back, you have a cauldron of instability which can be blown up. And the key to this is that this area, the Tibet Uyghur area, has always been the target of British imperial policy as a way of breaking up the territorial integrity and the sovereignty of the nation of China, much the way the Sykes-Picot Treaty was used to redraw borders, often secretly, throughout the Middle East area, and set one nation, one ethnic group, one religious faction against another, fighting over pieces of turf.
Are you saying that the headquarters of and the operational centers of these organizations, which are blowing up one part of China after another, are in London?
Yeah, exactly.
They wouldn't be nearby to the headquarters of the Tamil Tigers in London, perhaps?
They may be in the same office building. In the case of Washington, you know, much of this operation was moved from London. For instance, the whole Dalai Lama Tibet apparatus, which has used this Dalai Lama to try to keep Tibet in a state of backwardness and to use it as a divisive operation against China's sovereignty. Much of this was centered in London until the 50s, 60s, 70s period, where it began to sort of migrate to Washington under British control. And you can see this in the sense that the head of this Uyghur movement, whom the Chinese have identified as the group and the person, the head of it, is a woman named Rebaya Kadir, whom they have accused of having set in motion these mass demonstrations which turned into riots on the streets of Urumqi. And she, in fact, has admitted on many TV interviews that she was indeed using the internet and telephone calls to call on the Uyghurs to massively demonstrate on the streets, having been provoked by an incident in late May in Guangdong, where there was a riot in a factory, which ended up in a Han versus Uyghur racial conflict, and a few people were killed. And this incident festered and was activated by Kadir in setting loose this demonstration, which rapidly turned into a massive riot. Now, it's instructive that just 6 weeks ago, in the end of May, there was a global conference of the World Uyghur Congress held in Washington, openly sponsored by every British intelligence apparatus active in Washington, the National Endowment for Democracy, a quasi-U.S. government agency which basically carries out George Soros-type destabilizations around the world, George Soros's Human Rights Watch itself, which co-sponsored, Amnesty International, which is essentially part of MI6 intelligence operations around the world, and that this conference was held in the U.S. Congress with a number of U.S. congressmen not only present but openly joining in the singing of not only the U.S. national anthem but then something they called the East Turkestan national anthem, East Turkestan being the term they use for the Chinese province of Xinjiang, which they are insisting must be made into an independent body, i.e. separating and splitting up China, just as they're demanding that Tibet, not only what we know of Tibet today, but what so-called Greater Tibet, which includes sections of other provinces of China, must be granted its independence or a kind of autonomy which would be equivalent to independence.
Let me just identify here for a minute that we are on the LaRouche show for July 11th. We're discussing the extraordinary webcast, the publication of a pamphlet in the next few days of LaRouche's June 27th webcast, to which he gave the partial title Britain Delenda Est, the British Empire Must Be Destroyed, and in which there is an extraordinary discussion of the prospects of a LaRouche-led leadership writing the policy of the United States, overthrowing the policies of Barack Obama from London totally, and forging a recovery in a U.S.-China-Russia-India alliance. We're discussing that specifically in terms of the attempts clearly underway now to destabilize and perhaps split up a number of nations in the so-called arc of crisis in Eurasia, as LaRouche warned in 1999 the British wanted to do. And we're discussing that with Tony Papert, intelligence, one of the intelligence directors of LaRouche's movement for many years, and with Mike Billington, who does a great deal of work on Asian intelligence and also spreading the ideas and the writings and so forth of LaRouche around in these Asian countries. Mike, I wanted to ask you, since you talked to representatives of many of these countries, is there any realization? What's the situation vis-a-vis blaming the United States as opposed to, in the case of Iran, for whatever reason, the current government of Iran very clearly decided that it knew that the British were behind this, the aftermath of the election, and other destabilizations in Iran, and has been blasting the British publicly and otherwise since. What's the reaction among the diplomats and scholars and others that you talk to?
Well, it's mixed. There's a lot of delusions still across Asia. A lot of people who simply continue to accept the idea that somehow the British Empire is gone and passed on, and that to some extent America has picked up that imperial vision. And fail to see that the empire is not a country. What we call the British Empire is not simply the nation of Britain or the people of Britain, but that it's this Anglo-Dutch financial institutional structure, which does indeed hold its headquarters in London, and which is targeting the United States as much as it's targeting any other nation on earth, that the entire globalization process was aimed at undermining that American system concept of developing the creative powers of its citizens, its productive powers of its citizens, through nationally directed control over its credit system, what LaRouche identifies as a creditary system as opposed to the monetary systems of Europe, and through that process, developing both the vast infrastructure, manufacturing, and agricultural capacity of a nation as a whole, but carrying that policy towards the rest of the world, living up to the idea of the Treaty of Westphalia from the 17th century, the idea that the sovereign nation state is in fact the true friend of our nation and every other nation on earth. It's that collaboration between sovereign states which is the only basis on which you can succeed in defeating the power of empire, which wishes to destroy that sovereignty. There is, however, in Asia, a number of nations and representatives from these nations, especially those who have been under British domination in the past, like Malaysia and Myanmar and to a certain extent the Chinese as well, who recognize in the Iranian response that the Iranian identification of the British role, not the so-called Great Satan in Washington, which you're expect to hear, you know, but in fact that it was the British intelligence role identifying the fact that it was Tony Blair who dragged the United States into the war in Iraq, and that it was the British who were actively sending intelligence operatives into Iran to try to create dissension and chaos. So that they're watching this Iranian response very, very closely. And I think I should mention that one Chinese scholar who's a longtime friend of ours recently said in his discussion of what's going on in Xinjiang and the Uyghur rioting that he recognizes this could be something like China's 9/11, And in further discussion on this, it's not just that they had a terrorist incident or something in their country, but that rather it could be used negatively against them as a way of rallying international efforts to target China's role, to try to accuse Russia of being, accuse the Chinese government of being responsible for the disasters that took place there last week, and which potentially could unfold further into other areas of Xinjiang. So in that sense, I think it's absolutely crucial that LaRouche's message, the message from the recent webcast and the message of this arc of crisis policy, has to permeate rapidly throughout this region for people to get a grounding, because the intention here is to destabilize countries to prevent them from collaborating, to prevent Russia, China, and India from working together around the issues, both in terms of dealing with this global financial breakdown crisis, but also to deal with this new opium war and to deal with the insurgencies being spawned by this Anglo-Dutch-Saudi apparatus.
Tony, I want to get back to what you raised before, Jeff Steinberg's new article and the Saudi role. But prior to that, let's just make clear, what is it that, from LaRouche's standpoint and what he's been saying, what is it that the United States, under some leadership other than what Obama's giving now, Russia, China, and India have to do?
They have to create a world credit system to replace the present world monetary system. I mean, monetary system and empire are really two names for the same thing. The empires are not a conquest of one nation by another. Empires are not a question of nations at all. That the world has been largely under imperialist rule for the most part since ancient Babylon, and particularly the succession of modern or more modern empires begins with the Peloponnesian Wars in Greece, which resulted in ultimately a monetarist empire over the Mediterranean in the form of the Roman Empire. But none of these empires were a case of a domination of one nation over another. That's a vulgar misunderstanding, which really stems from miseducation. The power of empire has always been, and the power of the British Empire today, which, as Mike said, is not a power of British people per se, but it's an international financier oligarchy centered in the city of London. But what that power of empire is the power of monetarism and monetary systems. What it is that the law for governments of the world today, especially the governments of Europe and the Americas, with some degree of exception of the United States, what the law for governments has been that governments must fill their functions of government by borrowing money from central bankers, or by borrowing money ultimately from private banking interests, mm-hmm. which is a network, an international network of private banking interests, which have their disputes, their competition, their even bitter fights. They can kill each other off, but when their common interests are at stake, they are one. They function as one unified oligarchic group against everybody else, and especially against governments. So the rule of monetarism has been that governments are dependent for their existence, for their functioning, on networks of private banking, and this is a most institutionalized, really, in the most extreme way, inside the European Union of today, where the individual governments have no control whatever over their own monetary policy, and ultimately very little control even over their own fiscal policy. This is delegated to an unelected bureaucracy in Brussels, which is in turn run by private bankers headquartered in the City of London. So that has been empire since the Babylonian Empire, since the Roman Empire, and since the Byzantine Empire, which succeeded it, the Venetian Empire, and then which then morphed itself into the British Empire of today. This has now brought us to a historic dead end. Within the terms of monetarism, which is the same thing as saying within imperial domination of the world as it's existed, especially since 1763, the modern British Empire, within those terms, there's no exit. We're going to lose civilization. We have to return to a credit system in which governments, rather than borrowing from central bankers, issue their own credit, which can become money or whatever, but issue their own government credit to fulfill the objectives of government, all the objectives in government, but in this case we're talking about, most importantly, projects of development to exit from a downward spiraling economic crisis, great project development. This can only be done by state credit. This can only be
done... Hamiltonian national banking.
Hamiltonian national banking, exactly. By governments which have broken from monetarism, as Hamilton did with the National Bank, as Lincoln did with the greenbacks, as Roosevelt did during the Great Depression, and then, you know, on into World War II and up until the point of his death. That is the only exit. Now, the United States has this built into our constitutional system, even if we've sometimes ignored it or discarded it under leadership of traitors and, you know, British agents like Obama. But we have it built into our constitutional system, built into our traditions, in a way which it's not in any other country. So the United States is essential for the world to exit from this crisis. But the U.S. itself does not have the strength to stand up against the British Empire. The strongest political force in the world is the British Empire. Look at the things we've been saying, this great sweep of arc of destabilization all across Asia, many other things we could cite, the control of raw materials, the control of oil, all these things, the world monetary system itself.
And using the military actions of the United States
against itself,
the apparent great national power.
In order to commit suicide. So the United States alone does not have the power to defeat the British Empire, but with these great other nations, Russia, China, and India, it can be done. I mean, of course, China, India, the world's most populous countries, by a long shot. Russia is not by no means so populous, especially nowadays after the demise of the Soviet Union. But it has key capabilities, scientific and other capabilities, toward the development of Asia. The Russians, like the U.S., have never been conquered in war by another country. They see themselves, or that's the way they see it, they see themselves as being nobody's, you know, puppet, nobody's fool, no part of nobody's empire. So by treaty agreement between these nations, we can, in a sense, expand the constitutional ability of the United States Constitution to create credit through treaty agreements with other countries, and by beginning with the other countries, Russia, India, and China, together we have the strength to take on the British Empire, to form such a system, whatever the British or puppets may think about it, and to invite other countries to join as they will. I mean, as they inevitably will, given the alternative, which is destruction. This is really continuing the vision of Franklin Roosevelt. This is basically the way he saw the United Nations organization, as an organization of independent sovereign states agreeing in a sovereign fashion to band together in behalf of certain essential interests of humanity as a whole, which in that period, in the period of his death, he saw that as taking the vast war machine which had been developed in the United States, the like of which has never existed on Earth, converting that basically to production of capital goods, which would be used to begin the process of industrialization of what were then colonies, but what had to become independent nations.
So, in other words, what we're seeing here and what we're discussing is the British operations break these countries up, and the United States has no means of escaping from this financial collapse.
Precisely, without these
collapse,
nations,
and therefore the British wind up as top dog in a ruined heap.
They hope,
in what they think will be a ruin. Now, the Saudi role here, you referenced a landmark or a bombshell article that Jeff Steinberg, it should be on www.larouchepac.com and larouchepub.com.
Later today.
Not now, later today. Saudis are obviously not great powers, and all those kingdoms there clearly monetarist. In fact, their monetary authorities seem to be run usually by civil servants from Britain or Australia rather than from Arab countries.
Exactly.
They're seen, perhaps because of the Bush legacy, as American allies, yet we find them as the major funding source for the terrorist groups that the U.S. thinks it's fighting all over the world, and we find them very heavily involved in London. What is it that is really exposed in this new information, this article that Jeff has brought out?
Well,
what's the Saudi role in this?
The details of the Saudi role, which is poor, largely new, involves the role of two Saudi intelligence agents and their wives in bringing together the two to three of the important hijackers in California, nurturing them, sending them to flight school, guiding them through the whole process. That's what's come out. These were people who were identified by U.S. police and U.S. intelligence as Saudi intelligence agents. But not only that, their training of the 9/11 terrorists, and these were the particular in the ones who did the flight, which was intended to be the second one which hit the Pentagon, which mm-hmm. fell over Pennsylvania. Their role in recruiting, training, flight training, and so forth, these terrorists, housing them, was subsidized not only directly by Saudi intelligence out of Saudi Arabia, but by checks from Washington from then Ambassador Prince Bandar and his wife, which totaled somewhere near $100,000 to these 9/11 terrorists, which went to them by way of their intelligence handlers. Now, the background in effect to that is that Prince Bandar was at the center of the Al Yamama case, which I mentioned here earlier. I didn't say much about it, I guess. But Al Yamama was a vast British-Saudi arms deal launched by Prince Bandar and Margaret Thatcher in 1985 and continued under Tony Blair and Prince Bandar during Blair's prime, one of the last acts of Blair as prime minister on his way out was to kill a British investigation by the Serious Fraud Office into this Al Yamama deal. But what Al Yamama did was, through subterfuge, it accumulated a vast intelligence slush fund, which is untraceable black money, mm-hmm. in the hundreds of billions of dollars. The exact amount is not known. Part of that went to Prince Bandar, who had negotiated the deal, who was then ambassador to Saudi Arabia. He, in turn, used it to subsidize the terrorists and the 9/11 hijackers and also their Saudi intelligence controllers. And then what the other thing is, of course, that all this was covered up immediately by Bush, who, as Paul mentioned earlier, was a great buddy of Prince Bandar, who was called the missing member of the Bush family.
And even more covered up by Blair, who ordered the cessation of the British Special Fraud Office investigation into this Al Yamama crime.
Yes, exactly.
But then we found the real missing member of the Bush family was the one in the White House. Anyway, go ahead. Sorry.
That is basically what came out, that this was Saudi-British, it was Saudi-British terror operation against the United States, which was covered up by the Bush administration in face of a lot of opposition. And it's actually the opposition which is coming out now. For instance, the investigators, this is all in the article which will be posted, the investigators by the 9/11 Commission, who said we have a problem that minders, so-called minders, of our witnesses, and in this case our sortie witnesses, so-called minders, FBI minders of our sortie witnesses, are coming to with the witnesses to our interrogations and telling the witnesses what to say and what not to say. Mm-hmm. We have a problem with this. This has to be put a stop to. So all this stuff has now come out, and there really is little mystery anymore about 9/11. It was a British sortie operation against the United States. Bush Cheney moved very heavily. For instance, this was known for some time, but they evacuated the relatives of Osama bin Laden who were living in the United States at the time of 9/11, were evacuated back to Saudi Arabia at a time when all non-military air traffic over the United States had been closed down immediately after 9/11. They put Osama bin Laden's relatives in planes and shipped them back to Saudi Arabia.
So,
Paul?
Again,
Paul?
Yeah, go ahead.
Can I make I'd like to sort of tie up some things here with an example of two other aspects of the Arc of Crisis. Because
Before you do that, though, I want to reiterate, look for that article on LaRouchePub.com and LaRouchePack.com later today. And secondly, we've got a question. I think it really goes to Tony from the LaRouche Youth Movement. How can you say that the United States alone couldn't defeat the British Empire? Are you saying that they would use their puppets to gang up on us? As it stands, the British would not be able to defeat the U.S. alone, correct? Please explain.
Oh, yeah, well, of course. Well, but we're not talking about the British as a nation. We're talking about the British as a British empire. It's not a question of the British nation. It's, yes, the British with their puppets in our midst, with their puppets who, you know, going back to the 19th century, you had the opium traders of Boston, the Perkins family and so forth, the financial center in Boston, the financial center in Wall Street, these London traders in our midst. I mean, even Roosevelt, when, you know, he had the overwhelming support of the American people, he was constrained in what he was able to do at various times in his administration by the British. We have the British puppets in our own midst. We have British puppet governments to a greater or lesser extent located around the world who are marching to the British tune. So it's not of course, the United States as a nation state is still, for all our catastrophes, it's still the most powerful nation state in the world. But that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about the United States as a nation state against the British Empire, which especially in our policy failings here since especially Kennedy's assassination and then since 1967-68, since we allowed the Bretton Woods, the British, to close down the Bretton Woods system through George Shultz and other people in our administrations here, since we resigned control of the U.S. dollar to the so-called euro dollars with the end of Bretton Woods, same thing. The euro dollars became the petrodollars. We have still today, the Rotterdam London spot market controlling the U.S. dollar through petroleum. All these things, not the British nation, but the British Empire has gained a stranglehold. And even a nation as powerful as the United States cannot, in fact, defeat. And Roosevelt found the same thing. But then, of course, the British were far weaker. Even a nation with the strength of the United States requires such an alliance to defeat the worldwide British Empire. That's the alliance we need.
Mike, we have only a few minutes. I wonder if you could also address the in recent international meetings, there have been reports of almost continual calls by Chinese and other leaders or officials for the replacement of the dollar by other reserve currencies. However,
it seems that I have something on that.
It seems that every report comes from Reuters, the British press agency. If you could also address what's actually going on with that, but go ahead.
Well, let me just say, can I say something on
that?
Sure. Mike doesn't know it, but Lin says he just got, Lyndon LaRouche said, he just got word from the Chinese government that the government does not oppose the dollar. The government supports the dollar, that this stuff is coming not from the government, but from others.
Go ahead, Mike.
On that subject, or I was going to say something indirect. I think what Tony just said adequately answers that. The attempt to push the Chinese and the Russians into a policy of dumping the dollar was simply an effort to get them to see an American empire rather than the empire, which is the British-centered Anglo-Dutch empire. And they're turning away from that foolishness, which could have, in fact, more rapidly blown up the whole world financial situation if they did such a thing. I was going to address something else. I don't know if I have time.
You have a few minutes.
Briefly, there's two other targeted areas on this arc of crisis. One is the Philippines, one is Thailand, where in both cases in the south of those countries, they have Muslim populations, which have over these last weeks just absolutely exploded into new cases of terrorism and chaos, attempting to bring down those countries. Now, people should not think that this is part of a clash of civilizations or something, or a Muslim problem against Christians or Buddhists. Because in both cases, the people who are, what happened there was that the Al-Yamama deal that Tony described was used by the British and the Saudis to finance the creation of these Al-Qaeda-type terrorist operations in Afghanistan. And then after the Russians, to fight the Russians back in the time of the Russian occupation. And after that, these people were spread back out to their original countries, many of them from the Philippines and from southern Thailand. And what you have now is an activation of these nascent networks, with those two countries being targeted for one reason being that the U.S. had a key role in preventing those countries from being dominated by the British Empire. In the case of the Philippines, we, of course, freed them from the Spanish Empire, which was a subset of the British Empire. And even though America dabbled with colonialism there for a while, Roosevelt made sure that that country was liberated. And Roosevelt stepped in at the end of the Second World War to make sure the British did not take over Thailand, which they intended to do. And that has been a long history since Roosevelt's death. But what you're seeing now is don't think of these as local expressions of some sort of breakdown or even ethnic.
Oh, I'm sorry. We seem to have lost the telephone connection to Mike. And I think he was getting to the point that again you're going to find the headquarters of the recruiting headquarters of these movements destabilizing these countries to be in London in every case and to be being recruited with Saudi money and often with Saudi export of ministers to London in order to do the preaching and get the and get those people together. So let me just. Turn it over to Tony for one final thing. I know LaRouche has another webcast he plans to give on August 1st. And again, I want to emphasize that the pamphlet of his extraordinary dialogue with economic and other elected leaders in the U.S. in his last webcast is about to appear. But Tony, in terms of why would the British want the collapse of the dollar, for example? What are we dealing with in terms of their end-game objective?
The collapse of the dollar would be the final blowout of the world economy. I mean, the world economy is denominated in dollars. China's, you know, world trade is denominated in dollars. China's, of course, assets, everything is denominated in dollars. Not merely a withdrawal from the dollar, but even an attempt to withdraw from the dollar, were such a thing to happen, would mark a final collapse of the world into ungovernability within a short time. And I mean, it's under those circumstances that the British imagine that their empire, by everybody else collapsing worse than them, everybody else being destroyed more than them, even though they're being destroyed too, that somehow they could carry on with their empire over a reduced, barbarized world population, as in some of the British science fiction stories, for instance, of H.G. Wells.
Okay, well, that gives us our what we're up against and our target in terms of the four power agreement and the long-term infrastructure development you discussed earlier. So with that, let me end the LaRouche show for today, July 11th, 2009. Let me thank Mike Billington, who was on for most of our show, and Tony Papert. This is Paul Gallagher saying so long for the LaRouche show for today.